The Bicek. Is it Bicek?
Bicek.
Okay. Thank you. I want to pronounce it correctly. Come again. No, it's quite, I find it very interesting. I didn't know you had such a surname, Bersak. Okay. Mr. Bersak is going to be presenting to us on the special economic zone. Members, I would like to get your attention, please. He's an investment, climate, and country risk specialist with a focus on the sub-Saharan state with over 15 years of experience. He has been a political and economic consultant advising corporations and international organizations on economic policy, political risk, anti-corruption, investigation, security, and sustainable investment. He's a consultant at the World Bank on investment climate reform and accelerated growth. His passion is on is about sub-Saharan Africa, mainly on how private sector can establish new partnerships in support of accelerated and fair growth. He'll explain to us what fair growth means. he's an expert on special economic zones and growth poles, and is the secretary of the World Economic Processing Zones Association. Has contributed to numerous projects and analysis since 1994, including for the World Bank and the UN. He's got quite a long history. What I'm going to be saying is that he's involved in a number of non-profit organizations promoting balance and sustainable growth and development. He holds a graduate degree in economic geography and political science from France and the USA. Members have, and our guests, I guess, they have his brief resume, and I hope that you can go through it just to acquaint yourself on who Mr. Claude Bersak is. I won't read everything, but I think this is just a little bit about Mr. Bersak. I think that's why we invited you here, so that you can give us your specialized expertise and help the committee actually have a broader understanding, since you've worked with the most important organizations in this world. Thank you very much for agreeing to come and talk to us on economic, special economic zones. You know, you are a highly demanded person and a quite involved person. Hence, we cannot just underestimate your really accepting our invitation. Thank you very much. May I, without a waste of time, introduce to you the members before you, so that as you talk to us, you know whom you're talking to. I will start at the back there. On my extreme left, that's Mr. Mohai, who is a member of this committee representing the African National Congress. Next to him is Mr. Ntuli, who is the whip of the committee representing the African National Congress. And then you have Mr. Mabasa here with a very nice and glamorous tie, I can see that. He's a member also representing African National Congress. And then on my extreme left, on the same row, is Mr. Ngonyama, representing COPE in the meeting. Oh, somebody says ANC. Still to represent the ANC in the near future, we hope. And then on this row, my row, I'll also start on my right. We have Mem Mbai Mohorosi, representing the African National Congress. Next to her is Madam Sotesi, representing the African National Congress. And then we also have our support staff. Next to me here is our content advisor. I think you've spoken to her quite a lot. You should know her. And then we have behind you, she decided to divorce us today. That's the committee secretary, Ms. Kaka. Why is seated that far? Where's Mabita? Oh, she's gone out. Okay. And here we have the PMG, which is the monitoring group in Parliament. They just in every committee in Parliament just to take notes of the deliberations of every committee. I'm not too sure the two gentlemen where they're coming from. They are too far from me. I can't even see who is who, unfortunately. We have other support staff there. Oh, they're from DTI. Okay. Oh, okay. I'll give you an opportunity just after I've introduced those three ladies there. I don't know why they're seated that far. Unless they're mending the door. We under threat, ne? That's why you're there. We have the committee assistant, Amanda. I think if you know Amanda, the surname is also giving me hassle, don't worry. She's that young lady there. Next to her is my PA, Miss Williams. And next to Miss Williams is the whip PA, Miss Peter. Yeah, that is the team that we have. I'll give an opportunity for the DTI delegation to also introduce themselves. May I give you the opportunity, please?
Slight correction, Chair. I used to be with the DTI. I am now content advisor for the Select Committee on Trade and International Relations.
Oh, congratulations. I don't know whether it's a demotion or you got a promotion. The next gentleman.
Chair, my name is Andrew Fisher and I'm from South.
Morning, Chair and members. My name is Kumbuzo Chabalala, Section Manager Committees.
Okay, thank you very much. That is the team. You're talking to us. You're welcomed. I also want to welcome them. We're meeting with Kumbuzo for the first time. That's why I didn't know that he's the manager managing the committees, committee secretary. Thank you very much. Let's not waste further time. Let's give it hand over to you.
Chair, honorable members and attendants, thank you very much for having me today. It's an honor for me to be here in this esteemed Parliament of South Africa. Thank you very much for your kind words, Chair. I just want to start with a note. I was told that I must expect to be grilled. So I thought that if I'm to be grilled, please serve me with barbecue sauce. I taste a lot better like that. But on a personal note, I've been involved with the SEZ since I'm a young student. And it's a personal relationship, really. When I was a student, child. I grew up in Mauritius. And Mauritius is a very small island where not much happens, particularly if you don't go enough to the beach. And we used to go to church on Sunday. My grandfather would take me to church. And you know, it's sugarcane field after sugarcane field and mountains and the ocean in the background and nothing much. And then there was this industrial zone that looked different. You know, when you were 5 or 6 years old, you looked for these patterns. And I said, "Grandfather, what is that?" And he said, "That is the export processing zone." And it just struck me as something extraordinary. You could see people coming and going, and factory workers. They were not tending the fields. They were doing something else. And you saw a lot of Chinese people coming and going, and big trucks coming and going. And that stuck to me. I thought, this is extraordinary. This is a small island in the middle of nowhere that produces sugar and tourists. And there are these factories that are doing these mysterious things. And as it turned out, the export processing zone of Mauritius was the foundation of a revolution in Mauritius. It completely changed this island from a sugar and tourism remote place of the global economy into something that has made it Africa's leading economy from a lot of standpoints. Not the largest, but the leading in terms of FDI and so on and so forth. But that's how it started for me. So I've been involved with SEZ now for nearly 20 years as a professional. It's not everything I do, but I do a lot of it. So I hope that what I can do today is share some insights from international experience. I've done a bit of work on South Africa, so I have some definite views about the IDZ and the SEZ program in South Africa. But what I would like to do today is bring into contrast, perhaps, what's happening here with international best practice and experience. And it's going to be a bit of a theoretical conversation, because I think the theoretical conversation so far in relation to what's happening here and what's happening elsewhere has been lacking in South Africa. So I hope that this is a bit of a foundation for the committee to interrogate what has been happening in government and in policy. And hopefully you can then contribute critically and usefully to this. And I want to tell you that I remain at your disposal in the future for any knowledge or information or anything you would like to. I have huge amount of data and information on SEZs worldwide. So this is what I hope to be for you, a useful source of information. So without further ado, I will just carry on through my presentation. If you find that it's going too slow or too fast, please, Chair, slow me down or accelerate me. I need your guidance on this. I've never testified in front of Parliament. So just as a background then, SEZ, as we know them today, have been around since the late 1950s. And they started essentially as trade facilitating tools, trade enhancing tools, known as free trade zones. And then in the late 1950s and 1960s, countries got the idea to add manufacturing to that. And there's a bit of a dispute about where EPZ first appeared, but the consensus is that they appeared at the same time, roughly in Mexico, in Ireland, and in South Korea. You know, about 30, 40 years ago, there were literally a handful of special economic zones. And nowadays, depending on the definition one chooses, there are probably more than 3,000 around the world. And they are now a prevalent tool of economic development, economic policy. And what's interesting is that they're not just present in emerging markets or developing countries, but just last week, the Prime Minister of Japan, Shinzo Abe, announced that Japan is going to deploy special economic zones to accelerate growth, because as you know, Japan has been mired in economic difficulties for about 20 years now. It's gone from being the miracle of Asia to the sick man of Asia. And the Prime Minister believes that special economic zones can do something for the country. And we'll talk about what that is. So what are special economic zones? You know, they're fundamental proposition, as far as I see it and as far as my experience tells me, is that SEZs are about government, and it's a government policy instrument, government creating an environment where it is easier and cheaper for the private sector to engage into economic processes. And those processes being the combination of capital, labor, energy, and knowledge to serve their markets. That's what SEZs are, creating a privileged environment for business to be conducted in an effective way. By implication, that means that the policy environment outside of SEZs, the national policy environment from an economic standpoint, is seen by those governments are not sufficiently conducive qualitatively and quantitatively for these processes of economic transformation to happen effectively and cheaply because of failures, because of constraints. Constraints on regulation, constraints of institutions capacity, and constraints on spatial infrastructure issues. So SEZs really should be seen as a policy instrument designed to alleviate these constraints. What's interesting about SEZ, and this is a matter, I suspect a lot of you will think that maybe this is a matter of ideology. I tend to think that it's a matter of pragmatic reality. But one of the key insights of SEZ as an economic policy, and you find that insight in very different places. China, for instance, Dubai or Mexico have all agreed to that insight, and that's why they've deployed SEZs in one form or another. Is that socioeconomic benefits like employment, wages, economic value added, profits, tax revenues, export earnings, and foreign direct investment are the positive consequences of a facilitated and properly regulated private sector activity. And that at its most basic, the function of government is to generate the conditions for those attendants to benefit to manifest. SEZs effectively are the manifestation of those principles. They're not the only tool, and it certainly is not the only goal of government create those benefits. But SEZs are a manifestation of a policy which intends to create those benefits through the private sector. And that's the fundamental principles of SEZs. SEZs are about creating an environment for the private sector to be effective at creating those benefits. I.e., it's not for government to do these things directly. It is for government to create the conditions for these things to happen. So why SEZs? You know, why do we need those special economic zones? And I'll come back to technical definition of SEZs later. Well, generally, and this is a matter of observation as well as a matter of policy, SEZs are tools of economic transition. They can be tools of political transition, of policy transitions, of political economic transition. Where do we see them being used? We see them being deployed in countries that are either heavily regulated and taxed, or lack adequate infrastructure, or where factors of production are poorly productive, are scarce, or misallocated, like labor, capital, and so on and so forth. So what we've seen in the past 40, 50 years is that SEZs tend to be deployed in very specific types of transition requirements. So to transit in a controlled way from a collectivist to a market economy, that's China and Vietnam, where government decides to use SEZs to make sure that the economy can slowly and progressively go from a collectivist, socialistic, state-centric, non-market economy to an allocative market process. And here what's really interesting is to contrast China and the Soviet Union and the collapse of the Soviet Union. Russia went violently from state communism to free market enterprise. And the result was chaos and social and economic and political restructuring. China, on the contrary, has chosen a progressive state. And Deng Xiaoping said that for them, for China, for the Communist Party of China, SEZs were, he used a very interesting metaphor, he said, SEZs are a tool that allows the crossing of a river barefoot by feeling for stones. So it's an instrument of political, economic, and economic transition. Now we see countries like Malaysia, for instance, and I think Malaysia is an interesting case for South Africa because it has a lot of similarities. But in the 1960s and 70s, Malaysia deployed SEZs to transit from a protectionist kind of structuralist endogenous industrialization import substitution economy to an open export-oriented economy. And Malaysia had a lot of problems that are not dissimilar to those of South Africa, where a minority, the Chinese minority, had independence controlled 99% of the economy. And the Malay majority was excluded from that. And while government deployed policies that were aimed at advancing Malay economic interest, it also decided to use SEZs where the Chinese portion of the population could freely invest in export-oriented global market economy. And that was highly successful, and Malaysia is now a fully open economy, has transitioned from a protectionist to a fully integrated economy where both minorities and majorities work together economically. But that was a long process. It took Malaysia about 20, 30 years. You also see SEZs being used in countries where reforms are simply too difficult to do. I'm doing a lot of countries in oil, work in oil-rich countries. I'm working in Azerbaijan, I'm working in Kuwait, I'm working in Mauritania. And governments there, you see SEZs as an enclave of economic policy reform where in the rest of the economy vested interests are stopping reforms from happening, whether it's tax reform, whether it's trade reform, whether it's investment reform. SEZs are seen as a pocket of efficiency in a very inefficient economic environment. And then you have what I think is possibly the South African case, but South Africa is difficult to characterize. In South Africa, my sense is that SEZs are being deployed to target reform, the investment climate, in a market economy which is burdened by regulation and inefficiencies, including in allocation of resources. But I think that's my theory about why South Africa is using SEZs. I don't think there's a consensus over why South Africa is developing SEZs, even in government. Now, the technical definition of SEZs, I should have started with that, but I wanted to contextualize first. So this is my definition, and it's in a book, so now it's the official definition. It's been published by the World Bank, so that's the authority. I'm the guy who defines SEZs. For me, what they are is that they are demarcated geographic areas contained within a country's national boundary, and I underline that, where the rules of business are different from those that prevail in the national territory. And these rules principally deal with investment conditions, international trade and customs, taxation, and the broader regulatory environment, including business licensing, labor legislation, and so on and so forth. And where the zone is given a business environment that is intended to be more liberal from a policy perspective and more effective from an administrative perspective than the rest of the national territory. Now, that definition is obviously open for questioning and debate. Now, in the expression special economic zones, there are three words, and I think they all mean something important. So I kind of, in my mind, break them down. And it reminds me, I used to work 15 years ago, I worked on the feasibility study for the Aqaba special economic zone in the Kingdom of Jordan. And there was an interesting meeting where one of the top policy Development, came to us, the consultants, and said to us with his Arabic accent, he said, I don't want sort of economic zone. I don't want kind of economic zone. I want special economic zone. And yeah, I thought, that's actually quite a profound point. Special. What is special? If a zone doesn't have that special, it's just a zone. It's just an industrial zone or a business park. What makes a special economic zone special? Well, what makes it special is that it is different from what happens in the rest of the economy. And that special has to do with the regulation of that zone. The regulatory framework, the laws, the taxes, the customs functioning, whatever, has to be sufficiently special that it is not just business as usual. And that the investor who locates there knows that he or she is getting special treatment that results in lower cost and greater efficiency. So that's what special is. You know, and economic, obviously, is about the fact that these zones, they have to be about processing. They have to be about creating value added. They have to be about resulting in investment that creates processes, that create job and investment and tax income, etc. And zones, obviously, refer to the fact that they have to be located somewhere and they have to be bounded and separated from the rest of the economy, and that they have to have special infrastructure. Otherwise, it's not a zone. Otherwise, it's the whole country. So stated differently, you know, for me, and that's a consensus with, you know, in the world of special economic zones. So they have, zones have to have three key structural constituents to be zones. And it's important because I do a lot of, you know, I do a lot of work with governments. And systematically, it's a really interesting process that takes place. So governments want special economic zones because they know that something's not quite working in their investment climate. And so they bring the World Bank or the UN or the IFC or the European Union, or they bring directly consultants like ourselves. And they say, give us, you know, special economic zones. In some cases, in Aqaba, they want special economic zones because the king said, we're going to do things differently. But in other countries, they want something different, but then when you offer them something different, they start being scared because you are breaking the status quo. You're changing the rules of the game. So the reality is that the most important element of the zone, and I'm going to talk a lot about that because I think there's a bias in South Africa towards perhaps the less important aspects. The most important aspect of the zone is you need to have a powerful, different, dedicated regulatory regime. You need to create a legal space which is effectively superimposed to the space, the physical space, where the rules of business are fundamentally different. And that means a number of things. You need to have usually one law, one SEZ law, one act of parliament that guarantees the safety of investment in that zone against expropriation, discrimination, or restrictions on investment, where the rules are very clear and you are guaranteeing the safety of that investment. That's priority of an SEZ. The second is that you need to lower the barrier of entry that are directly attributable to regulation and actually rules and practices. Now I'm going to say something that is potentially controversial, but in an SEZ, in some countries, they would, for instance, consider not having BE rules. You would have BE rules if you invest in South Africa, but if you are an investor in an SEZ, you would not have to have BE rules. But perhaps the condition would be that you cannot sell your production on the domestic market. You can only sell it on export markets. So the rules have to be different. And you have to have a number of regulatory measures that significantly decrease delays and costs that are directly caused or attributed to rules and practices of business, like licensing. In an SEZ, what you want is you want people to be able to come in, apply for a business license, and boom, it's done. And it's known how long it's done. It's not, oh, apply for your business license and maybe you'll get it in a year's time. It is, there's a law that says business licenses are attributed within 2 weeks or 3 months or 2 months or 3 days. It doesn't matter how long, provided it's not too long and it's international best practice. But that's the key. That regulatory regime is the foundation of the SEZ and it must provide a transparent, streamlined and cost-saving set of rules that create investment and operating conditions that compare advantageously to international and regional best practice. When you do an SEZ, you don't want to be just good enough, you want to be the best. Because what you're trying to do is you're trying to compete to attract the best investment worldwide in a world where everybody is competing against everybody else to attract investment and create jobs. That's what SEZs are about. They're about saying, we are open for business, welcome to South Africa. And we will give you business conditions that are better than what they do in Botswana. That's in essence what the proposition is about. The weaker the law, the more compromised the law, the less differentiated it is from what happens in the domestic economy, the less attractive your business proposition is. So element number one, component number one of an SEZ is the regulatory framework. And I've just spent a bit of time qualifying what needs to go into it. The second element, obviously, is the physical infrastructure. And this infrastructure, usually we know what it is. It consists of an industrial park, an industrial zone, business parks, and so on and so forth, which have serviced industrial plots. Sometimes they have factory shells, warehouses, offices, incubators, training centers, etc. They have good connectivity, they have green spaces, and they are world class. And they are effectively and cheaply connected to accessing local markets for labor and international markets for commodities and production input and exports. Railroads, airports, ports, and so on and so forth. Now, the physical infrastructure is often what people see. I mean, when I was a kid and I was looking at those EPZs, what I saw is I saw factories and industrial zones and people coming and going. I didn't see the regulatory framework. I didn't see the legislation. And so I didn't get as a kid that I was missing the most important part. So in most cases, what people see are the physical infrastructure of SEZs, and that's what they fixate on, and that's what they put a lot of effort. But it's an important component, but it is not the most important component. You can have fantastic infrastructure, and I've seen that. You know, this notion, if you build, they will come. You have fantastic infrastructure. Governments have spent literally billions of dollars. But the regulatory framework and the institutional environment is wrong, and people are not going to commit because people don't care about infrastructure. Companies don't come to a country because it's got great infrastructure. They come because it's cost-effective, because they can move their assets in and out quickly. They can serve their markets, and they can remain competitive. That's what they look for. Third element, third necessary attribute of SEZ is the governance institutional structure. Implementing a good regulatory regime means having good institutional capacity. You can have a very good law and you can have a very good infrastructure, but if there is no one to enforce the regulation, if there is no one to accompany the investment, if there is no one to promote the zone, if there is no one to certify zones, candidates, zones that have applied, companies that have applied to have SEZs, if they have no strong authority to go to, then the regime will remain dead and the industrial zone infrastructure will remain empty. excuse me. Now, in it's an interesting one, this, because, you know, when people think about the institution of SEZs, they think about the one-stop shop. The one-stop shop is important, but it's not just what there is. There is a lot more than that. But I will come back to that. So these are the three constituents: the regulatory regime, the infrastructure, and the institutions that run the infrastructure and the regime. So by implication, if an SEZ doesn't have all of its attributes, it doesn't qualify as an SEZ. If a zone is called a zone, as an SEZ, but it does not have duty-free operation, where companies can bring their capital equipment without paying custom duties, and they can't import their raw materials without paying custom duties, and they can't export the production easily, that's not an SEZ. Call it whatever you want, it's not an SEZ. So IDZs in South Africa aren't SEZs. They are kind of, sort of, economic zones, but they're not special economic zones. At the same time, if you don't have a simplified investment code, it's not an SEZ. If you don't have good infrastructure, you're not an SEZ. Just going to go back on types of zones now. People ask us what zones. I'll go very quickly. So accepting all these constituents of SEZs, what do we have? So we have commercial free zones, where most of what happens is trading and exporting and warehousing and light manufacturing and small transition, small processing of goods. You have some countries that have done extremely well out of them. In Panama, they have a zone called Colon. It has 2,000 companies in it, and all they do is they connect North America with South America. They're on the Panama Canal, so it's a major trade route, and companies come here that want to sell goods to North America or sell goods from North America to South America. They have hotels there, they have exhibition rooms, you can trade, you can buy, you can start. That's what they are. Export processing zones, we spoke about it, it's about manufacturing for exports. Mauritius comes to mind, Korea. In some countries, you have free enterprises. So the status of EPZ is given to individual companies. They're free to locate wherever they want. In small countries, it makes sense, like Mauritius or Singapore, because your company is always going to be 20 kilometers from the port, so it's not an issue. The more interesting one are what is called the free ports, or the Chinese model special economic zones. I mean, I don't know if any of you has been to China to see what goes on there in those SEZs. But I mean, these are towns, these are provinces that have been turned into special economic zones. People live in it. You know, it's not just an industrial park of 50 hectares or 150 hectares. It's a whole region where everything that happens in that region is run by one authority, a special economic zone authority, which effectively act as a governorate, but where the rules of business are different. So tourism it takes place under that. Trade, retail, banking, real estate development, all of that operates under those different rules of business. And the whole point is to show the country that things can happen differently and that people will gain out of it. And we'll talk a bit about the political economy. In 2010-11, I was involved in a lengthy study by the World Bank where we looked at lessons of 40 years of SEZs in Africa. And we looked at all the projects of SEZ that have happened in Africa. Togo, and I worked on Togo, and Mauritius, and Ghana, and Senegal, and Kenya, and South Africa, and Madagascar, and all of them. And we came up with a number of key lessons, and I'm just going to distill the key message. Chair, are we doing okay on time? And, okay, thank you. We looked at the exogenous factors and the endogenous factors that influence the success of SEZs. And the overwhelming conclusion was that except for Mauritius and a little bit in Kenya, EPZ, private SEZ have mostly failed in Africa. Failed. They haven't played the role that they play in Latin America and in Asia in turning the ship of the economy around. And so we ask ourselves the question, why is that? And in terms of exogenous factors, the first conclusion was that success tends to be determined by the size of the market that is accessible to the investors in those zones. The bigger the market, the greater the opportunities, the greater the economies of scale, the more likely success. So if you do an SEZ and your market, for some reason, is going to be just South Africa or just SACU, you are going to be constrained. If you do an SEZ and your market is China, you already have an advantage in terms of cost. So that's the first market. The first lesson is SEZs have to be targeted at large markets, and they don't have to be domestic markets, but international markets. The second factor, the second condition, is that the national economy itself has to be competitive. What we found is that countries that are not competitive, and I'm not going to name countries, but I know quite a few, and they create SEZ. You see, the problem is that their factors of production tend to not to be competitive. So they really struggle to attract competitive companies and be out there, sell goods in the market. So condition number two is you have to have the condition of competitiveness in your economy. Your factors of production have to be competitive. Your infrastructure has to be good. So it's a bit of a hard message because it tends to say that, you know, the world economy and SEZ only reward winners and that losers tend to be excluded. These are the lessons of the world. I would qualify those because I believe, and the past 40 years of economic development has shown us that one can change one's destiny in economic development. The third, the condition is that government capacity has to be strong. Now this, for me, is critical. Government capacity is the key. I've been working for 5 years on a special economic zone project in the DRC. And I don't believe in it. I think, you know, it's one zone too far. I think the level of dysfunction of that government is so high. The level of corruption is so overwhelming that they can't even do SEZ properly. So we've seen that. The stronger government capacity, the greater the chance of success. In terms of endogenous factors now, so we know there are those exogenous factors, size of the domestic economy, competitiveness of domestic economy, and government capacity. But the whole point of SEZ is to try to change things for the better. So while these factors are important, what we've also noticed is that countries that actually have, I'm going to list 8 factors, countries that manage to do SEZ programs with those 8 factors working for them can change their destiny. They can defeat the odds against, you know, their place in the world. So the first factor in the success of an SEZ project, whether you are as a country competitive position or not, is political support, political will. Strong political support from government, from parliament, from the private sector, from the unions, and from the different branches of government to develop an SEZ program and make it a success is the essential condition for success. Where you don't have government support or where you have insufficient government support, success tends to not be present because the public administration doesn't work effectively with government to make it happen. The private sector does not believe in it and does not invest in it. The unions resist and fight it, and it fails, or it does not succeed sufficiently. The second key element is that the program must be an integral part of national development strategy. Your SEZ policy has to be part of your broad economic policy. It mustn't be just an accident or something that you do on the side. It must be part of what you're doing as your strategy to improve the destiny of your population, as a strategy to grow your economy and to be more competitive. The third factor that is critical for the success of SEZ programs are sustained administrative support from the public administration. That's key. Your tax service, your customs service, your immigration service, your labor department, your commerce department, your energy department, your ports and airports, and so on and so forth, must buy into the project. And they must be involved in designing the policy. And they must be consulted about it. And they must actively cooperate. There must be consensus. That's key. Another one is that you must have a coherent set of investment support measures. Now, when I say that, people think I'm talking about tax incentives. Investment support measures. People immediately, when they think about SEZ, they think tax incentives. And I know that for South Africa, it's been a very contentious issue, tax incentives, for IBZs and SEZs. You know, I'm not, certainly not advocating, you know, the kind of tax incentives you see in some countries. 0% tax for early days, you know, 0% tax, corporate tax for 15, 20 years. It's not effective. What you need is you need a balance of measures that creates a compelling, competitive environment. Tax is part of it, but there are much more important things than taxes. Business licensing is important. Access to labor, competitive labor, productive labor is important, is key. Having electricity at the right price is key. Having a labor legislative environment which allows one to use one's labor within norms, obviously, of human rights and law, but to use one's labor according to the demands of the market is fundamental. So what's really important is to combine what we call incentives with investment support measures that together with quality infrastructure and a good institutional framework create a compelling offering for the investor. Obviously, we talked about the infrastructure, it's essential. And what we know is that you don't need to have extraordinary infrastructure, multi-billion dollar infrastructure, to attract investors. What you need to have is you need to have good, internationally good, cost-effective infrastructure with the right utilities at the right price. Price is key. Quality and price is key. There's no point in doing stuff over the top that is going to cost everybody an arm and a leg. Another key element, and this is something that I will talk about a little bit later. A zone program is a package. What a zone is, SEZs are packages of competitiveness enhancement measures. It's competitiveness turbocharged. That's what SEZs are. There is no point in developing a package of incentive measures and infrastructure and locational advantages and so on and so forth if one does not know the economic problem that one is trying to solve. Zones can't do everything for everyone. They can do certain things for certain places at certain costs. So the key issue when one does a zone project is to understand what are the constraints to investment, to economic transformation, to exports, to attracting foreign direct investment. What are the constraints in that particular country? And one should design the SEZ program to relieve those constraints. Otherwise, one is missing the target. So it is fundamental, and this is when I do projects. I'm currently working in Azerbaijan, Georgia, Lesotho, Botswana, Mauritania, the DRC. You know, my first message to government is, let's look at what the problem is. What are we trying to solve? We're doing SEZ for what? And the first thing we do is we look at the competitiveness issues of the country. And we do a complete scan of the competitiveness issues and constraints. And then we tell ourselves, right, can SEZ contribute to solving those problems? And if they can, in what way? That's what you need to do. It needs to be a rational, analytic process, not an ideological, not a political one. Another point of importance is private sector participation is essential, not just at the end of the day when investors come and they put their factories. But the private sector tends to know better what's going on in a country in terms of constraints on business investment and operation and legislation and regulation. It's important to consult them and ask them what is it that they need to be able to invest more in that country rather than go invest next door. And, you know, so when we run a program, we involve national business associations, international business associations, and we ask them what is it that's working, what's not working. And then what we try to do is we try to see if they can help us design this thing and make it work. And the last one, I'm not going to spend time on that, but it's important to make sure that the zone does not function as an enclave in the local economy. It's not essential, but it's important, and we'll talk about it a bit later. I'm just going to spend a bit of time on what I know about the South African experience. I did a bit of work on it. I did an analysis about 3 years ago of the IDZ program for a policy think tank. So I spent a bit of time on it, so I know a little bit, but probably less than you do. So SA has been, you know, toying with SEZs for 20, 25 years. And the first element is the IDZ. Now, from a strictly definitional standpoint, IDZs aren't SEZs, okay? Because they don't provide a duty-free environment. And the custom control area has never really properly worked. There is no dedicated IDZ investment support measures, but rather there is a garrison, and I call it a garrison because I've seen the list of incentives available, it's just massive. So there's no IDZ regime, but there is a series of existing regimes and tax incentives that exist for the country and where one locating in an IDZ can apply for. And it's extremely complicated and confusing. And then the national regulatory regime on everything applies. So IDZs are part of the national territory from a customs standpoint and from a business licensing, taxation standpoint, incentive standpoint. They're just very fancy, well-equipped, well-endowed, I'd say sometimes not ideally located, big industrial zones that receive support from government. So they're not SEZs. And from our analysis, the IDZ program performance has been a problem. From a design standpoint, it was designed in a bureaucratic fashion with insufficient consultation and lack of relevant international benchmarking and best practice. I think the whole configuration of the program was problematic from a strategic standpoint, what they were supposed to achieve in terms of national economic development. The choice of location near ports turned the program into a regional development scheme, and it diminished its efficacy as a tool for national competitiveness investment. The incentive structure and application processes were and are complicated, difficult to understand, and burdensome from an administrative standpoint. The governance structure has been complex, and the investors have found that it is insufficiently responsive. There's been a lack of consensus, buy-in and support for the program overall in South Africa. I think in government, in business, labor communities in particular. And importantly, and I think this is something that needs to be kept into the mind as the country goes develop SEZ is the program has been very expensive. The emphasis has been on the program, the IDZ program. It's been expensive. It's required a very large amount of capital investment in infrastructure. The incentives are costly to the treasury, and the economic benefits so far, although I think things are improving, the economic benefits haven't been evident. The costs so far have been superior to the benefits to the country. I think, you know, DTI has recognized that to a large extent. The DTI several years ago acknowledged that there were problems with the IDZ program. And I think the SEZ program in theory is there to correct some of those issues. And that's why the DTI has said that the IDZs will now become part of the SEZs and will be incorporated in that policy. So the IDZ policy will disappear, the SEZs will become part of that, and they will fall under the new law. But we were, my company was hired about 2 years ago to do an analysis, a year and a half ago, to do an analysis of the draft bill then. And we have some strong views on what we've seen so far. We feel that there's still a lack of policy consensus on what the SEZs should be from economic, socio-economic development standpoint. There is no agreement right now on what the investment support measures should be. And I'm not just talking about tax incentives, I'm talking about the whole package, licensing and regulatory framework. So as a result, the law is hollow. It leaves most of these very important measures out to be resolved at the later stage through regulation. But the result is that there is uncertainty about what the SEZ legal regulatory proposition is going to be from an investment standpoint. And there's a sense of muddle through that somehow the process of designing those incentives and measures will resolve itself over time. That's not best practice. In terms of integration in the National Development Strategy, in theory, SEZs are connected to the IPAP and the NGP. But I think there are serious questions about coordination between all these policies and the NDP. I think the result is confusion over goals. Is the SEZ policy about FDI? Is it about exports? Is it about industrialization and beneficiation? Is it about decentralized economic development? Is it about jobs? Is it about experimenting with economic liberalization? Is it about infrastructure? Or is it about everything? There is a lack of clarity over that. Some of the sustainable initiative support I discussed earlier, I think what's clear is that there is a lack of interdepartmental coordination right now over not just the incentives, but for instance, things like delegation of authority. Now, usually how SEZs work is this. The best SEZ model is when you have a zone authority which has been given the power by the different ministries and administration to license businesses on behalf of. So you don't need to go to the Commerce Department anymore to get your business license. You don't need to go to the building departments to get your construction permit. You don't need to go to the Labor Department to get your certification to employ people. You don't go to the safety department, the health safety department, to get your factory certified. You don't go to the tax department, revenue department. Everything is there at the SEZ. And in the best case, the SEZ authority is acting on behalf of government through delegation. I don't see that happening in the case of South Africa. I think there's still a lot of debate between, for instance, the Department of the Treasury and the DTI over investment incentives. I know that there is lack of support for the notion of simplifying labor rules. and not just from the Department of Labour, but also from the unions. So this means that right now, as we stand and we look at this zone law, we still don't know what the value proposition is from an investment standpoint. You know, and I say in my presentation something which will be controversial, but you know, it's been documented in surveys after surveys of investment confidence and sentiment about South Africa. One of the key problems in South Africa right now is the labour legislation. I'm not going to say labour costs. People say it's about labour costs. We need low costs in our zones. I don't agree. What we need is we need flexible terms of employment. And that's not available at this point. And it's unfortunate that SEZs are not being seen in South Africa as an opportunity to try something else, to try something new, where we know that the main business environment is cumbersome and leading to job losses. Infrastructure offering. Now, it's too early to tell what kind of infrastructure offering there will be in the SEZs, but I think if we look at what's happened with the IDZs, we can expect that these SEZs will have fantastic infrastructure. I think this is one strong point for South Africa. South Africa has the fiscal and the technical capacity to deliver world-class infrastructure. This is a good thing, but it's also, I want to raise a point of caution. I think too often in South Africa we see the role of the state in infrastructure as almost, we don't say it, but I think it's there. We see it as the strong point which allows us to compensate for other weaknesses. And so we tend to over-invest in our infrastructure. We tend to over-design our IDZs. We tend to over-design our airports and our ports because we think that, well, if we build those, at least that's tangible, they'll come. But I send you back to what I said earlier about SEZ. It's the whole package that counts. As an economist, I look at SEZ and I say, they're only good if they bring more benefit than what they cost. You know, if it costs 10 billion rands to develop an IDZ and attract investors and give them tax incentives, but you've only managed to create 6 or 5 or 7 billion of rand of investment, then you've lost 3 billion rands. So if you've spent 10 billion rands developing an IDZ, that includes infrastructure costs, and it includes the cost of incentives, of tax incentives, and if it includes, you know, everything you've done, but you've only managed to attract $5 or $6 billion or rands of investment, you've lost $4 or $5 billion. I'm against SEZs when they cost the country more than they bring it. I say, you know, treasury is a rare thing, is a scarce resource. Tax income are scarce resources. Let's deploy them where they are going to have an impact. So I sense that in South Africa, you know, there is an overemphasis on infrastructure and costly infrastructure. And there is a lack of balance over the other measures that I discussed. I spoke about the fact that, you know, it's very important to root an SEZ program on a clear understanding of one's comparative advantage and weaknesses there too. Now, if I look at the SEZ program right now, I'm not convinced that it has been based on a really thorough, objective analysis of what is constraining growth and investment in South Africa. And I use two pieces of evidence to support what I say. And obviously I stand to be questioned and contradicted, and I will accept that this is very high level view. But one of the things that tells me that it hasn't been done is the fact that there's been a focus on sectors, right? I know that the DTI has conducted thorough sectoral analysis of where the opportunities are in South Africa, the different industrial sectors. And I know I've spoken to a couple IDZ management who told me that, you know, effectively, they thought that they will have to specialize in this or that industry. But then I say to them, well, where are the feasibility studies that demonstrate that this is the sector for you? And they say, where are the feasibility studies that show that this sector or that sector is the right sector for that particular SEZ? And they said, no, there is no feasibility study. It's kind of a broad national sectoral identification. I said, yeah, but how do you know that this matches you, your comparative advantage, your labor endowment, your locational endowment? For me, that raises questions. The second element that brings me to question whether comparative advantage is really truly the foundation and understood as the foundation of what needs to be done is the locational. You know, government has, I believe, already identified 10 SEZs and 2 per provinces. I don't understand that logic. You know, why 2 per province? I know that, you know, towns and have been said, you will have an SEZ and that's going to be an SEZ. But why? On what empirical foundation? Why not 5 in one province and 1 in another, or maybe why not no SEZ in some province, which doesn't have what it takes? You know, I think 10 SEZs to develop is just an enormous order of magnitude. And the costs and the capacity requirements is just going to be just staggering. Private sector participation, another important point. Well, I think that there's been insufficient consultation between the government and private sector on the SEZ policy. Private sector associations have complained about that repeatedly. And they have said that, you know, they are being given that SEZ policy as a given, but that they question the rationale, the measures, the incentives, the location, the sectoral focus. The governance structure, which is very government-centered and very, very bureaucratic, I believe. And, you know, the whole point, as I said earlier, is to develop SEZ, is to get the private sector to jump in and invest. So if you don't consult with them, and if you don't involve them in the design and the choice of location and invest in the infrastructure and running these things, chances are your thing is not going to be very attractive. Private. Sorry, am I not being clear? Yeah. You know, this is about the public sector working with the private sector to make something happen, investment. So you got to consult them. And the evidence is that there's been insufficient consultation. Now, you know, if you look at the IDZs again, and you look at Kuha, for instance, you know, DTI now is clearly showing that investment is happening. We're seeing a greater number of factories, we're seeing a greater number of jobs taking place. So DTR will say, well, this is, finally, we are being vindicated for our investment and our policies. Then I go back to my point, yes, at what point, at what cost? At what cost? You know, my concern is you're going to have 10 SEZs, and how much is it going to cost to make them work? You know, how much money are you going to have to give in each investor to come? That's a key concern. So I'm just going to conclude, and I thank you for your patience. But I say that again. You know, SEZs are about reducing business uncertainty, creating clear and easy rules, and decreasing the cost of doing business. I would propose, this is only my personal conclusion, that the key lessons from the IDZ policy and from international experience have not been sufficiently learned and incorporated in the design of the SEZ program in South Africa. And that 3 things need to happen to make the program a success. 1, a clear set of investment support measures embodied in law that convincingly resolve barriers to investment and economic activities in South Africa, and where there are no sacred cows. That's what successful SEZs are about. No sacred cows. Changing the rules of the game. without paying too much attention to vested interests. Number two, a simple regulatory and institutional structure that gives the regulator the powers to regulate and enforce regulation with a meaningful simplification of business licensing. And the third one is a greater role for the private sector in setting up SEZs, managing them, choosing locations and sectors according to market demand and not top-down bureaucratic policy. Thank you very much. I am at your disposal for the grilling.
Let me thank you very much, Mr. Pesak, for this mind-provoking presentation. It is quite mind-provoking. I think my colleagues have found it very interesting, and especially to interact with you on this particular matter. I'm happy that you were here and then you gave us a broad understanding, you know, overview of this with your experiences in various countries, and of course based on the studies that you've done. Thank you very much. May I allow members to ask questions? Yeah, this is difficult now. I thought it was going to be easier. It is a bit difficult for me. May I, for the purposes of this this session, question and answer session, just go that side so that I can see my members. Okay. Mr. Mabasa has an appointment with the doctor, so that's why he's sneaking out. I wanted him to move out, not to sneak. Just move swiftly. Thank you. Babuntuli, I've noted Jundasim Muhai and Babungonyama, Methodist.
Thanks, Chaperson, and I would also like to welcome the presentation. Chair, I want to check with Mr. Biasak whether he has been able to look at the infrastructure development bill, which is it's out there for the comments, which is coming from the economic development. I wanted to check that if he has seen that, and if we compare it with the SEZ, the Metus Operandi, or the way they are crafting it, whether it is not moving in the right direction. I'm saying this considering the government structural of our country, where we've got the three spheres of government, where you've got national, provincial, and local, and we say all these spheres are independent. I mean, when you look at what it is trying to do, the infrastructure development, I just wanted to hear from you, what is your comment when you compare it with what you have presented? Thanks.
Honorable member, I haven't.
Just a second. I think what we should do is just to note the question and then perhaps and then respond to them. If it's okay with you, it's fine. Okay. Are you done?
Yeah.
Okay. Dr. Mohai?
Thanks, Chairperson. I first of all do agree with you that it's a good presentation as well, and it's very enriching, I think. But also I also like the fact that at the conclusion it did make an assessment, much more comprehensive assessment on South Africa. Mr. Pisak, my problem, I think, is on, it's contained in a presentation. You did highlight somewhere where it says that it should be liberal from policy's point of view, but very effective administratively. If one looks into countries roughly, there is this whole notion where that in all the social or liberal democracies, irrespective whether under conditions of instability, but growth prospects are so much higher, quite a number of countries. Even if you look at it today in Africa, growth in Nigeria will be around 7% or so, and South Africa is even revising its projection downwards in terms of growth, economic forecast. But South Africa as well does have a very strong development framework or legal, all these things that you ideally want for a thriving economy you do have in South Africa. For me, it seems that the problem that South Africans are paying dearly is around labor legislation, which I do have serious problems, because even the forum of business that facilitates or dialogue between business and labor at NetLand. And it not long ago, recently, South Africa, we have tabled legislations, I think amendments to parliament on labor, particularly labor broking. And the serious elements that are embedded on labor broking is that if we would agree with what business was espousing, it will trap majority of South Africans in socio-economic conditions of poverty for a very long time. And in its nature, it is untransformative. So to always harp on the issue of labor without business addressing on the... Because I think we have alluded to it. It's an issue of transition. South Africa is moving from a particular phase, peacefully. There is no war here, but there are serious challenges. I mean, if you can address the issue of labor, and I'm a bit, it's quite disturbing, because it seems to me it is the issue that the country is paying dearly without compromising on labor or liberalization. It means that you're not going to move an inch in growth and development in the country. Thanks, but those are some of my issues. Thanks.
To end with the leaders, you know, ikundwane elikhuluma selifikile nje lele lincane lenokungafuni nje ku ukulandela. I want to give you the advantage, the time now. I'll end with the Gundwane Elincane.
Well, Chairperson, I must also appreciate the input by Mr. Pisek, and especially because it's a frank input, and it does not spare the rod in terms of the analysis, especially with regard to South Africa. And the issue with me is the point that has been raised by Mr. Muhaye, and moving from the historical point of view and maybe posing it as a question to you. And I do know that you've made the point in your conclusion about with no special And in other words, with no, nothing must be what? No sacred cows, yes, no sacred cows. That's it. And I assume in a situation like South Africa where you have serious historic imbalances, even South Africa cannot be spared in a situation of trying to make sure that SEZs do function and beneficiate the country. And I assume that is the point, and that is embedded in that statement. And I want to throw it back to you, Mr. Pisek, as to, in your own experience, you've been to countries that have gone through emerging and out of the doldrums of colonialism. What is it and that we can actually infuse in order to redress the imbalances when it comes to that? The second issue is, it does appear to me that the most important component in this whole and a sort of a scenario that you painted to us with regard to South Africa vis-a-vis the other side, the ideal or normative and cases of successful SEZs is the question of consensus. If I were to just put, that's the bottom line. There must be consensus, that's what you're telling us, that between the government, business, and labor in particular. And how do you reach that consensus? I want to put that point to you. And how do you also factor the issue of the constitutional imperatives? And that also relate to the legislations and that flow out of that constitution, so that whatever that you do is not unconstitutional. Because in a democratic state, you may even be taken to court if you trying to create special to an extent of even undermining what belongs to the people with regard to the constitution. The other one, and I must say that I am very, very happy by the point that you have made, that the issue of the IDZs and SEZs in South Africa, and because this is the observation that personally I made, even in my budget speech, there hasn't been thorough analysis of why we are moving from IDZ to SEZ, for instance, and do the SWOT analysis, why it is important for us to move in that direction. And that analysis done now by the department, especially that you have been appointed as a person? And are the points that you have come up with here been appreciated by TTI? And that these are some of the challenges. The last one, Chairperson, we are now participating in various fora, BRICS in particular. And how do you see us as South Africa and positioning ourselves strategically within BRICS so that these our own SEZs and are in a position to leverage betterment of our economy? Or you think that our participation within BRICS, especially around SEZs, we are not competitive enough with regard to India, to Brazil, for instance? Thank you.
Thank you, Babu Ngonyam. Methodist.
Member Ngonyam has said everything. He represented me. Yeah.
That's why he wanted to speak before him. I know. Even when we are not talking, you always talk.
Okay, like you correctly said, the presentation is, quite challenging, difficult than I expected, but also a friend in a way. As I was listening, maybe I missed a point, but to listen at the same time, looking, try to read the document. I don't see the presentation, seeing something, or maybe being informed of the latest development in South Africa, whereby we have forums where business, labor, governments are playing a role, not left to just mention one. Also very inclusive as a community as well, is represented in NetLab. And much as I appreciate the role played by the private sector, like we have that structure where they participate. But looking at the history of South Africa, where private sector systematically so contributed largely to poverty in South Africa, but the government of South Africa is not the one that we play, games like dwelling into the past. We have to move forward to benefit the country as a whole, and not trying to, to play games like revenge or whatever. I don't know which term I use, but there's a lot of progress. And I was expecting, to come across a statement which appreciates that and also criticize constructively where the plans, developmental plans that are in place, where they are weak so that we can improve. Because we have a lot of plans regarding infrastructure development, but a plan is a plan. Implementation of that plan is something else. It needs to be criticized from time to time or monitored from time to time to check if it's still on the right track. And taking into consideration the sense of living in South Africa, what to do, what do you consider as a reasonable living wage, particularly the mining sector and the farming sector? If we talk about a living wage, what would that figure be? A reasonable figure that will advantage both the employer and the employee. I think others, like I say, we don't want to be sure almost everything. But we really appreciate and we get educated every day, especially from knowledgeable people like yourself.
Thank you, Mayor Sotis. Just from my side, your assessment of the ITZ vis-a-vis the SEZ bill, the new legislation that has been proposed before Parliament, is taken. What I really do not find is the differentiation between the two, because one is in existence, one is not in existence as yet, and therefore the criticism sometimes I find it a bit unfair. The movement between the ICZ to the SEZ, so remember the ICZs were mostly in the where the EC, what do you call it? Huh? Yes, around the ports. And the SEZs are now focusing inland, wherein I think when government looked at that was saying no, the over emphasis in the areas, and I think you have a critique around that, it's not helping the situation because it tends to focus on those provinces that are within the or around the sea. But then this is what I see even with China development, their new strategy. They tend to have noticed that with looking towards the sea areas as against the inland areas, you're not really helping in terms of development of the areas that are mostly inland. And I think this is one lesson that would say I would want you to perhaps maybe you have learned, you have lessons like that, and perhaps Mauritius as an island, that's why it's thriving because it's more, it's much more easier to deal with the economic growth points that are along the sea, or is it much easier with those that are inland? What is the difference, and what, in your experience, perhaps what is more viable and that would make growth much more, you know, quicker and seamless? I think those are the issues that is what I think you need to focus on in terms of your response to my issue. But I also feel that the issue around the impact assessment studies, I would tend to differ that there's no information on that because, you know, the IDZs, before they were started, that impact assessment was done. I say this because I happen to also participate, and I think Mr. Ngonyama can also attest to that because he was involved as a leader, political leader in one province that was still, that had one or two of those IDZs. I don't think it's fair also to say there was nothing, there was no impact assessment done, because I know that is a prerequisite before you start any problem. Maybe nationals might not have that type of information, but I'm sure that, hence my question, that perhaps the issue is more around coordination and synergization of programs and projects between different spheres of government, I think as my colleague earlier on asked a question. I just want you to respond to that, whether you agree or you don't agree with me on that. I also want to say South Africa has seen a need for special economic zones. I wanted you to perhaps focus more on the weaknesses that you see currently in this new legislation on special economic zones. I don't know whether you had an opportunity to present before the committee on trade and industry when they had public hearings. Huh? Yes. On that, because it will be, I think for a committee like ours, it will be very beneficial because we're more looking into the issues around job creation as much as we're looking at issues of development and growth. Development versus growth is very important because we don't want development that doesn't come growth that doesn't come with the people's development. And when you look at people's development, I think the main thing is around jobs. Yes. I think I will also want you to look into that. But while I say that, it is important that I also mention that South Africa has always approached things differently. And I think we do so because of our, you know, our political or general, you know, background, historical background, which had to do with the way, you know, I think Babu Ngonyama raised the issue of a government trying to address the challenges that we had before. And it's very much important that you also track down, as we deal with the current issues and developmental issues, track down our approaches vis-a-vis our policy direction that we've been taking. And of course, what is imperative is what directs us as a country, which is our constitution. We can't move away from that. We have to, in every way and means, try to follow that. Yes, if you look at that approach, what would you say, or let me ask this question, would you look at things differently in the way we approach things, or would you still insist that South Africa is not complying to certain things? Yes, can I leave it there and give you an opportunity to respond?
Honorable members, Chairperson, thank you for the questions. It's a wide set of questions. I think it's important for me to, when one makes a presentation like this, one has to choose what to talk about. I spend a lot of time in South Africa. My wife is South African. My children are South African, born citizens. I'm not a resident in South Africa, but I consider myself to be a South African by adoption. So I'm aware of the history and the difficulties. I didn't want to go into that because I felt that what I need to be for you is I need to be the kind of independent technical expert on SEZ who does international work. And so although I did share a bit of my limited knowledge and experience about what I see is happening in the IDZ and the SEZ, I felt that what would benefit the committee is kind of what's international norm, how is it happening internationally, what makes good SEZs, what makes SEZs successful, what makes bad SEZs, what makes SEZ fail. And I hope that this has been useful. I can spend a lot of time talking about South Africa. It's a country that I find absolutely fascinating and that I love, and I study a lot. So I will try to answer the questions one by one, and hopefully that gives you some of what you're looking for. I haven't seen the infrastructure bill, so I cannot comment on it. I find the question about the relationship between the three spheres of government very interesting. And if I may comment in relation to the IDZs, for instance, yes, three independent spheres of government that have to do things independently and cooperatively. You know, the IDZ policy initially was supposed to be driven by the private sector, and you were supposed to have private sector operators that were going to take the lead, and you have one in Richards Bay. But that hasn't really worked, and if you take East London, for instance, it is presented as a private sector because it's a limited corporation. But it's a provincial initiative. It's owned by the provincial government. Is that private sector? No. Is it intergovernmental cooperation? Yes. But where does the money come from in the end? It comes from Treasury. So I think it's important to be aware of that. And, you know, you can skin a cat how many way you want. At the end of the day, you know, if the same person keeps on paying for the bill, you have a problem. The liberal policy versus administrative efficiency, the role of the state and markets in development, you know, the performance of the West, economic performance of the West, or perceived lower performance of the West versus the new emerging markets, the China, the India, the Brazils, is a difficult one. You know, what I find interesting, and I'm not going to go into this because it's so complicated and demanding, but what is interesting to me is that what we know and what is accepted is that, you know, the greater the social dislocation, the greater the negative impact of colonialization, the greater the impact of war, the greater the need for government. You know, that's a given. Nobody questions that. Even Western liberal democracies engage in massive amounts of controlled socialism during crisis. And we saw that in the United States, nationalizing its automotive industry 5 years ago. What's interesting, really, is the balance, striking the balance between who's responsible for what. You know, what SEZs are to me is a tool that tries to strike that particular balance at a particular time in a particular political economy. So obviously it's important to take lessons from what's happening in China and Botswana and wherever else they have SEZs and try to get the best of that. But one also needs to be aware of what's special about South Africa and what we can and cannot do. South Africa is such a strange animal because it has, on the one hand, a very liberal economy, you know, with a dynamic private sector, which is mostly unfettered. And actually, I would surmise, largely underregulated. You know, I mean, there's a real problem of competition in the South African market. I think there is lack of competition, there is collusion between actors, there is antitrust behavior, there is anti-competitive behavior, which damage the national interest, the interest of the consumers, the interest of labor. We see that. So, you know, don't take me as an advocate of private sector and anti-government. On the contrary, you know, I would like to see at once a greater role for the private sector in investing, because the reality is that the South African government does not have unlimited capacity, technocratic, political, and fiscal, to do it all. And the private sector has enormous reserves and resources of capital that needs to be mobilized. But for me, the condition of the social contract, or the social compact between the members of society, is that, yes, the private sector must invest, but it must do so in a way that is socially, legally, morally responsible, and that competition must be guaranteed so that prices are low and goods are available. That's my view. So, what are SEZs in that capacity? SEZs are tools of policy for government to, sorry, I'm going to lose power, I'm going to close this, are tools of policy for government to decide who gets what and who does what. You know, I think South Africa needs SEZs. Yeah, I think South Africa needs SEZs. But I think South Africa needs real SEZs, as I've defined them. Location of labor, man, I mean, you know, that's yes, you are right. It is one of the fundamental questions and unresolved problems of South Africa. And when we see what's happening in the mining communities and mining industry right now, what's happening in Marikana, what's happening between the unions that are fighting one another, literally fighting one another, when we see indeed what happened in Parliament, what's really, and that's a side comment, but what's really concerning, I think, as an international man looking at what's happening, is that we're so very far from consensus. You know, we can't agree, or the polity can't agree on basics of policy, and labor and business can't agree on basics. I agree with you, the country has a phenomenal tradition, recent tradition, but a phenomenal tradition of solving problems together and debating them. But at the same time, I think the country is debating itself into 1% growth per annum. What is that good? And I don't mean that to be a political comment, but what good does that do to the country? And so the question of consensus, and I go back and forth to your different questions and try to come up with something that makes sense. Yes, you need consensus, but yes, you also need political and policy direction. You need commitments. You need, government drives policy, and government makes the decision, and then government says, that's how we're going to go. And you ask the question, how do they go? How do they do it elsewhere? Well, it's always difficult. There's no such thing as an easy road. I think, yes, South Africa is different, but no, it's not different. Social conflicts abound in all societies. Minorities and majorities contesting for power, contesting for wealth, contesting for access. Bad history. I'm French. My father's home when he was a young boy was occupied by the German army. He grew up with the German army there in his house, and his father 4 years in the concentration camps. I think the world history is a history of violence, dislocation and abuse. And I think sometimes South Africans see themselves too much as exceptional, perhaps. And that's a personal comment. But maybe that stops us from doing sometimes the hard stuff. You know what I'm saying, Chair? Sometimes it stops us from saying, well, that's what is right. And if we're going to do, and I'm not telling you what you need to do, but if you're going to do an SEZ policy, do it well. Or don't do it. Do something else. The cautionary tale of, what I presented today is that if you don't do it well, it's going to cost you a lot of money. You're going to be spending a lot of money on infrastructure. You're going to be giving a lot of tax incentives. And sometimes you're going to be giving tax incentives to companies that were operating somewhere else in the country, shut down their factories, come and locate in your SEZ or IDZ and get a tax rebate. You haven't created new jobs, but you've lost tax revenues. So there are real issues about that. So if you do an SEZ policy, do it well to be the best. That's my point. The labor legislation issue, it's a political matter. I'm not going to be the one telling you what needs to happen. What I think the message is clear is that there is, from an international standpoint, from a competitiveness standpoint, from an access to labor standpoint in South Africa, there is a real problem. And that problem is not finding a solution right now. Issues like the youth wage, for instance, which in theory is a simple, non-threatening solution because it does not displace anybody in theory. That is controversial. So I can appreciate that the notion of bringing into regulation something about labor condition is going to be very, very difficult. But in my view, and that's what SEZs are about, SEZs are about, in the case of South Africa, I would propose that SEZs are about experimenting things. Experimenting things that are not acceptable otherwise between social partners. I would suggest that, if the government could see South Africa, SEZs in South Africa as, let's try something different and let's see if it works. Let's try different roles for the private sector and let's see if it works. Let's try to have a one-stop shop with real authority to issue licenses away from the different departments. And let's see if that works. Let's try a simplified labor hiring and firing procedures. But we agree with the different social partners that it's circumscribed to those SEZs. And and that all the social partners, we're going to give it, say, 5 years, and we're going to see what it does. Because, you know, this whole thing about, you know, growth versus development, you know, I don't buy it. I'm sorry. I don't buy it. There is no such thing as development without growth. There is not. No development happens without economic growth. I don't buy the notion that development, economic development, and economic growth are at opposite of one each other, of one another. I hear a lot of that argument.
Sorry, it's not economic development. Development.
Development as a whole.
Yes.
Development and growth.
Economic growth. Yes.
No, I understand. Development as in social, human, environmental development as balanced. Yes, but the experience shows it that we cannot. I mean, if you look at human history, if you look at 500 years, for instance, the past 500 years, what do we see? Or the past 50 years in Asia and Latin America, is what we see is we see that social development, health development, life expectancy, all of these things improve with high economic growth. They don't go back. You're not going to find a single country where economic growth is over 5 or 6% per annum consistently for 20, 30 years, and where the social development indexes, human development indexes, has reversed, have gone down. Yes, you will see increased inequality in some societies. But increased inequality doesn't mean that not everybody's standard of living is increasing. I'm not saying increased inequality is good. All I'm saying is that empirically, without fast economic growth, societies don't progress. Health is not improved. So when I hear the notion in South Africa that, you know, we're going to debate all these things, we're not going to do these policies that are controversial or that are potentially undermining, you know, labor, for instance, I'm saying the result is low growth. South Africa, compared to the BRICS, South Africa is the slowest growing member of the BRICS and has been consistently the case for 20 years. And I would surmise that it is not surprising that we have all of these social dislocation problems as a result of low growth. Low growth impacts government revenues. Low growth equals low tax income. If you have massive amounts of social expenditures, you have to borrow the money. You borrow money in foreign currencies. When your currency depreciates, your international position becomes more scarce. I think what South Africa needs is high growth for 20, 25 years. And my sense is that that will take away a lot of the pains that we are seeing in South Africa. But I hear you. You know, there is that fundamental distrust in South Africa between the market and the people, the market and labor, because of the past. The question becomes, how do we resolve that? But we can't resolve that only through conversation. Because as I said earlier, you can converse yourself and debate yourself to 1% growth. So the question about this, I'll go back to SCZ. And, you know, you've asked me big questions, and I'm trying to give some, from my simple experience, some elements of maybe how that ties in with SCZ. If you look at fast-growing countries in the world, if you look at China, and if you look at Brazil, and Mexico, and Malaysia, and Singapore, and Taiwan, and Korea, and so on and so forth, all of them have used special economic zones as a tool of transition from low growth to fast growth. All of them have done that from low employment to high employment. I mean, I go to Mauritius. When I was a kid, I mean, people don't know that, but when I was a kid, there was a state of emergency in Mauritius. The press had been curtailed. Political meetings were banned. I mean, you don't think about that when you think about Mauritius. You think about success, exports, technology, textile, electronics, etc., and beaches, and financial services. I remember very clearly Mauritius was on the verge of social explosion. There were talk of revolution in 1977, 78, 79. You know, and what government got is that they had to give jobs to people. You cannot grow a fair and safe society and stable society when people are unemployed. It doesn't matter how much you give them per month, you know, welfare allocation. You can't do it for 20, 30 years on a sustainable basis. It's going to break the back of your fiscus. So, you know, they created the special economic zone to that effect. And so, obviously, there was a lot of political opposition against that. Exploitative labor conditions. The Chinese are going to come and they're going to put our workers in factories and we're going to be paying low wages. Yeah, and there's an economist that said something, and I don't know if I agree with him, but I think it's worth kind of putting it in our head. You know, better be exploited for some time than thrown away. And you know, when one looks at South Africa today with this incredible rate of unemployment, you know, you have a sense of tremendous waste of social capital. You know, tremendous waste of social capital by people not being gainfully employed, by not contributing to their families in a way that makes them proud, and by not learning skills and passing that on to their children, etc. And I think, you know, that's what SEZs are supposed to be. Now, they mean making hard decisions about all these things. I don't see how there's another way, by the way. I mean, you know, if in 3 or 4 or 5 years' time South Africa hasn't managed to find a way into higher growth, what's going to happen? You know, if it's what's happening now in the communities, with all these community protests and this labor instability now, you know, how is it going to be in 3 or 4 years' time? I mean, I find the proposition concerning. That's what I mean by no sacred cows, sir. It seems to me that when the DTI looked at its IDZ policy, it went in, and I don't, it's just my impression with dialogues that I've had with them. I haven't worked for the DTI, so. But it seems to me that they did their own diagnostics very cautiously, you know, not to upset whoever it is that mustn't be upset with hardcore diagnostics. That's what our policy is, that's why it's doing well, that's why it's doing wrong, that's what we must improve, that's what we must change. I have a chance that they kind of went with kid's glove onto these diagnostics of what's happening, what's not happening. And therefore that the new SEZ policy design, you know, it's IDZ plus, you know, it's not SEZ. It's IDZ plus, a little bit plus. There's a law. There was no law for the IDZ, so we're going to have a law. We're going to call it a law. But the law says nothing besides the rules of governance, besides this board and that board and the provinces and this. And it doesn't say, bam, this is the investment position, this is the taxation, this is the licensing, this is who's going to be in charge. It doesn't say it. It doesn't say it because nobody is actually daring to say, that's what we need to make it work, and that's what we need to grow in South Africa. So that's my take on it. So what is it going to take? It's going to take political leadership. It's going to take policy leadership. It's going to take people saying, this is where we are going as a country, because if we don't go as a country, this is what the future is for us. And yes, we need to deal with fair taxation, and we need to deal with fair labor, and we need to deal with issues of local economic development, and we're going to try it and experiment it on ICZs. And we're going to say to business and labor and government, this is what we're going to do for 10 years or 5 years experimentally. And we're going to do it with one zone. Not 10. I mean, that's my take. And we're going to do it with one zone in a place that has everything it needs to have to succeed. It has labor, it has infrastructure, and we don't need to spend 10 or 20 billion rands to make it happen. So we're going to put it where that all is. Where it is, I don't know. I would have a sense it's around Gauteng. Please. Am I going too far, too much and too far?
No. This is quite interesting what you say, and quite thought-provoking. Babu Ngonyo.
Jefferson, I must be honest, this is very, very interesting. Because, you know, Jefferson, I may differ with Mr. Bisek. But one thing that I like about it is that you're basing it out of the interest of the country and also out of your own experience with regard to what has worked in the world. However, I want to argue with you that we don't have the luxury to make experiments in South Africa. We can't make experiments. You can make an experiment in UK or in France or in Germany, but in South Africa and anywhere in Africa, I want to argue, we can't make experiments about what this can work, this cannot work. And therefore, my other question that I was definitely going to come up with, was the issue of the. You ask the question, in South Africa, SEZ for what? And you said, it's a fuzzy. And I wanted to say to you that, why can't, in a situation where there is high rate of unemployment, where there is underdevelopment, where there are imbalances, it's SEZ for job creation. That's the bottom line. And anything else with regard to the issue that we refer to, licensing, tax, and so on, or labor and the laws and so on, everything else should be targeting job creation. So the bottom line in South Africa is about job creation in order to ensure that there is this growth that you're referring to. You are correct in saying that there is lack of social capital, rather. I don't know how you wastage of social capital. Precisely because there's no addition to GDP by so many people. And therefore, how can you be experimenting in that kind of situation, Mr. Bisa? So my point really is that we must be very clear. We don't have space to experiment. I want to argue very strongly myself. That's number one. Number two, the point that I wanted to is over designing of the infrastructure, the point that you made. We tend to over design our infrastructure and so on and so forth. Perhaps you are correct. The tendency is to ensure that you have good infrastructure that will be in a position to attract investment, FDI in particular, and even with regard to domestic investment. To be much more sustained. And is it wrong really for long-term purposes? For long-term because you need infrastructure. The reason why the economy of South Africa has become much stronger than many in the continent is because precisely because of that competitive advantage of having this infrastructure which is over-designed and whatever the meaning of the over-design is. My point is, for long-term purposes, we need that infrastructure. We didn't have the stadiums today, but we have stadiums. That's why we had the World Cup and various other and the key activities of the world are easily attracted to come in the continent through South Africa because South Africa has got that over and the design of the infrastructure, which has got a number of, has created multiple issues. I'm throwing these things to you, and perhaps the last one.
I will share it again.
Okay. The last one, who is the regulator in the input? Who is the regulator? Thank you.
With Mr. Mohai, I think he looks like he has a follow-up. Okay.
Yeah,
sorry for the disturbance in your response.
I still have a lot of questions unanswered.
Yes. You know, as you speak, Mr. Pesak, I think the problem is that as you speak, on as you respond, I think people have certain follow-up. That's why I'm going to allow that the whole meeting of today be dedicated to this, because it's important that we have an understanding of what you were trying to tell us. Yes.
Thanks, Chair. I think there are a couple of examples that have been made of countries that are succeeding and so forth. Mr. Pesak has talked about Malaysia. What is it? This one, Mauritius. There's a Singapore, which he said is a what city, country, city state. Out of nothing, it emerged to be an island of significance throughout the world. But obviously, the point that I was raising earlier on is that it appears as if there has been unconditional support from the rest of the world in making this country succeed. They have not succeeded out of nothing. Even Mauritius as a destination, the guarantee that out of its location, there's guaranteed interest that will generate a business. So we're making a point that there should not be something very difficult, but we are correct. We need on our own to review our own policies based on the balance of evidence, whether they yield positive results or not at any given time. We have to do those things. I agree also with the point that there are areas of over-design on some of the, maybe on the special economic zones, to say what exactly you need. Because also we need to find a way of utilizing the conception of over-design. We've seen studies continue to show in China what is a factory is different from what I grew up knowing the factory back home. I used to know a factory, something big, physical infrastructure, but it can be something very small, something very productive with 18 or 20 people operating there, high technology. So there is that kind of conception, and precisely because we are developing country backward as well, whilst we are adapting in terms of technology or having those features of highly advanced, developed economy and so forth, as you alluded to. But I think there is something that where we need to streamline, to say in the context of areas of strength, because the point that was raised earlier, when you say SEZ for what, when we said that we are beneficiating, we want to increase value chain in the economy, all of those products that are produced in the country, we need to find a way. So there's evidence in terms of country, in the country, where there are areas of growth or potential areas of growth, even in provinces. I mean, in the Free State, we may have an area of growth which may warrant SEZ, either in the agricultural sector, as a primary sector of the economy in the country, or in any other sector in the country. But I think those things, whilst they are properly articulated in policy, they need technical feasibility to justify their inclusion as you said. Thanks.
The question of experimentation, do we have the time? I think the country is experimenting constantly. I mean, policy is an exercise in experimentation. I would surmise that the National Development Plan is experimentation. I would surmise that the New Growth Path is experimentation, and that the Industrial Policy Action Plan is experimentation.
the beneficiation strategy is experimentation. We don't know if it's going to work. And as a matter of fact, I would surmise that there is plenty of evidence that it's not working, because it is based on the notion that we have abundant and cheap electricity, which clearly we don't anymore. You know, the role of the state in rolling out all that infrastructure, that's experimentation. We're not seeing the results of that yet. So I think there is experimentation right now taking place. Policy is a bet into the future. The interesting thing about SEZ is that, in essence, and this is where I think they are misunderstood in South Africa, is that it's a wage, it's a bet, it's a wage, a hedge, sorry, it's a hedge. It's saying, right, while for political reason, for ideological reason, for political economy reason, South Africa has embarked on development path, which is quite state-centric, frankly. You know, why don't we give ourselves an insurance policy with a parallel track of development and growth, which is based on the ICZ with lower regulations and, lower taxes, combined with infrastructure and combined with greater responsive public administration, one-stop shop, and so on and so forth, so that we can see over the future the balance of evidence between the state-centric, state-driven, parastatal-driven economic policy, and something which is more responsive to international market forces based on comparative advantage that changes fairly rapidly. See, the thing is, comparative advantage changes all the time because nobody is static. So while we say that, five, six, 7 years ago, government was thinking, well, we must beneficiate, and and the ANC through its policy deliberation processes identifies the policy direction, but by the time it gets into government and by the time government is implementing it, 7 years have passed, and as we say in French, the cheese has moved. Electricity is no longer an abundant and cheap resource. But that's where we're going. So for me, SEZ are opening a tool of experimentation, an alternative, which can serve as a transition if the other policy doesn't work. I'm saying, I agree with you, it should be about employment. And I think one of the fundamental vulnerabilities, weaknesses of economic development policy in South Africa right now is that it is employment unfriendly. If you look at government policy, it's about heavy industrialization, it's about capital intensity, it's about processes out of beneficiated processes out of our commodities, which may make intuitive sense but don't necessarily make economic sense anymore. And there is a strong bias against labor-intensive industries in South Africa. Because they are associated with exploitation, because they are associated with bad working conditions, because they are associated with low wages. And I said earlier, wage levels aren't necessarily always the problem. I mean, yes, there is a whole debate about what's happening in textile in KwaZulu-Natal, and the notion that if, in Newcastle, the minimum wage is imposed, these factories will close. But we can't generalize the proposition that, the minimum wage has to be 750 rands per month, or South Africa can't compete internationally. Because it's not about wages, it's about productivity. It's about unit cost of production. The price of one thing is not determined by how much the worker was paid, but how much it costs to be made. And that's not the same thing. Because you can pay someone 500 rands per month and that person is going to be very unproductive. Or you can pay that person 2,000 rands a month and that person makes three or four times more money than these. It's about unit cost. That's how the world works. And so I tend to believe that this is where South Africa has a role to play. It has to come up with a policy environment that creates jobs for people, puts people back to work, and give them employment. And yes, it may not be what you and me, we think, is decent employment, but it might very well lead to that. I mean, if we take a place like Mexico, okay, 40, 50 years ago, the Maquiladora program, okay, Maquiladora. So there was a problem. But these things are fascinating, you know, because if we judge things over 2 to 3 years, we judge them wrong. If we judge them over a generation, then we start seeing things properly. So in Mexico, what happened is during World War II, the United States needed a lot of labor for its factories and its fields because all the men were at war. So they allowed Mexican workers to come and work in the United States. But after the completion of the war and the return of the American soldiers, the United States, you know, looking after its own interests, said to all these Mexican workers, thanks but no thanks. Bye-bye. They were pushed back home. They were people who had lived from all over Mexico, and they ended up being concentrated on the border, south of the border, which is still an area, as you know, of massive social dislocation and problems. But what happened is that the American government set up, and that's about help, what could governments do to help one another. The American government allowed Mexico to export its commodities, its goods, manufactured goods, to the United States at lower duties. The idea was that they were going to help Mexico to give jobs to these peoples by creating duty-free entry into the American market. And very soon what happened is you saw a lot of American companies investing on the border, on the south of the border in Mexico, in factories and in industrial zones. That were the precursor to export processing zones and special economic zones. By 1990, it represented 1.2 million jobs of Mexicans that weren't paid very well. And in the 60s and 70s, it was mostly textile and mostly luggage, you know, labor-intensive, low-skill, low-paid jobs. If you go to the Mexican border now, they do cars, they manufacture computers, they manufacture fridges, they design stuff. It became the foundation for Mexico, the United States and Canada to sign NAFTA. They learned to deal with each other. So it created trust and confidence between Mexico and the US. They were not buddies at that time, as you know, there have been several, you know, centuries of bad relationship. It created the foundation for NAFTA to be signed. And then, you know, workers, and we see it in China now, you know, China 20 years ago, cheap labor, unsafe conditions. Nowadays, China is bleeding manufacturing jobs. They're going somewhere else. Why? Because the use of all that Chinese labor has created skills, it's created productivity, and it has led to wage increases. The market has done its thing. Now, it doesn't solve all problems, ma'am. You know, I'm not a believer that the unfettered working of the market will solve society's problem and it will be heaven. No, no, I don't. What I believe, however, is that if we tap, you know, into those resources and we allow them to be used productively, they can contribute to society, increase our growth. But there's still problems. The problems of pollution, there's problems of dislocation and so on. They need to be solved by government. Government is there very often to solve the problems created by market. I want to go to the questions of, you know, what model of development, coastal and peripheral versus central. It's a really difficult one. And it's very difficult in South Africa. This is where I think South Africa has been really damaged by apartheid, is the homeland policies of forcibly removing people from where jobs were and where the economies were and putting people where there are no jobs. I think that is, together with education, that's the most damning legacy of apartheid, is that people aren't where their jobs are, mostly. And what do you do about it? And I don't think there's an answer there, an easy answer. But if I look at evidence from international experience and even South African experience, we see that creating decentralized economic development is very difficult to do, very costly to do. Very difficult and costly to do. Because you don't have social capital, you don't have infrastructure, you don't have assets, except if it's, agriculture, minerals, resources, and so on and so forth. But in most cases, it's very difficult to do. Now, SEZs, to go back to our conversation about SEZs, there are very few special economic zones that have been successful at creating decentralized, peripheral economic development. Very, very few. And one of the reasons is simple. One is you don't have trained, educated, worldly labor force. Two, it's very costly to do infrastructure, so it has to be subsidized. It's very costly to ship goods back and forth. And unless there is something quite unique, like a body of minerals or cheap electricity because it's near a dam or something compelling, businesses don't invest in those places. Now, an interesting story that goes against that is Lesotho. Do you know that currently Lesotho employs 40,000 people manufacturing garments, apparel, textile for the American market? Did you know that? I was there a month ago. I'm doing something for the World Bank there. You got to go see it. I mean, it's next door. You go to Maseru, 40,000 jobs. It's one of those things that that beguiles the mind and it asks you questions. How can some places develop out of nowhere? You asked a question about Mauritius. Is it easier for Mauritius than South Africa? I use the word ocean-locked country. Not land-locked country like Lesotho, but ocean-locked. Mauritius is far from anything. It's far from its investors. It's far from its markets and consumers. You know how expensive it is to ship something from China to Mauritius, and then it goes all the way to America or to Europe? South Africa has far more in terms of social capital. Mauritius has 1.2 million people. South Africa has 48 million people. You know what you can do with 48 million people? South Africa has mineral resources galore. It has infrastructure. It has connectivity. It is part of the great continent of Africa. It's got a huge market. Mauritius doesn't have that. Lesotho doesn't have that. Now, you go to Lesotho, 40,000 manufacturing jobs making garment textile for the U.S. market competitively. That tells you that with the right policy, with the right policy environment, with the right support from government, and with the right market access, you can pretty much employ anybody and turn these people into productive contributors to society. And they use the SEZ. I think I'm going to... Is there any question that I haven't answered which needs attention, Chair? The regulator, yes, okay. That's an important technical question. There are several models for that. In some cases, a ministry like the DTI or the Ministry of Economic Development will be the regulator. In other cases, and this is now what is favored, because it has more power and more independence from government, you have an independent entity board that is established either as a parastatal or as a limited liability company or a division of a particular government, or sometimes directly working with the Prime Minister's office or with the presidency, which is endowed with the power of regulation. There's an interesting model for that is the Aqaba Special Economic Zone, where the regional government of Aqaba, Aqaba is in Jordan, it's in the south, it's the only port of the country, the regional government was disbanded and a new regulator was created which acts also as regional government. So it's a province and it's a special economic zone authority. And that authority has been delegated powers by all of the public administrations, immigration, customs, taxation, police, and so on and so forth. And when you are an investor and you want to set up a business in the Aqaba Special Economic Zone, you deal with only one institution, it's that regulator. And that regulator, so that regulator, the way it worked is, it's one of my colleagues drafted the law, government drafted the law, created the authority, and then the authority created all the regulations itself. And it acts as an autonomous body of government. Now there's merit, pros and cons for that model. You know, yes, Taiwan, South Korea, Mauritius, Singapore have been helped. But the most important help is access to market. You know that point about the key differentiator is having access to a big market. Lesotho is being helped. Lesotho is being helped, but no more than South Africa. Lesotho has access to the American market through AGOA. South Africa is a member of AGOA. It's access to market through preferential trade agreements. Now, do you know that South African textile companies are closing shop and they're going to Lesotho? They're investing in Lesotho. I asked them why. I mean, you're far. The roads between Lesotho and Durban, it's a long way around. It's costly. It's very costly. Or to East London, it's even longer. But you know, I asked the question to the investors, South African and foreign investors, why not South Africa? You know, and their answer is unfriendly regulation, uncooperative public sector administration, and difficult, fractious labor unions. That South Africa is just not attractive enough as an investment destination. I'm not saying that. That's what people say. You know, and I would say, as my last maybe advice is why don't you guys do this? I mean, it's cost effective. Go to Lesotho, organize yourself a mission. Go visit factories, go visit the LNDC, the Lesotho National Development Corporation, and ask investors what they find in Lesotho that they don't find in South Africa. I think it would be really interesting. And then see what that means for the SEZ program. What could be done to resolve these problems and bring back the manufacturers, the South African companies that are leaving South Africa's shore, bring them back home and attract FDI, as you say.
Yeah, thank you very much, Dr. Sek. I think we've clearly understood you. We had the message from you on SEZ. SEZ, yes. Babungo Nyama, ITZs were experiments. Were pilots, if you recall well. The three that we had. That's why at some stage there was a moratorium on further ITZ. This was precisely because of some of the issues that you raised. But South Africa is moving further. It's saying we need special economic zones. Come again?
Well, Jefferson, unfortunately, the context of my comment...
No, I understand, but I'm moving from
the context
what
of my comment
said,
on
yeah.
The issue of why SEZ in the context of South Africa is different from the experimental issue that
that he
Mr. Bisek was referring to.
Mm-hmm.
I still maintain that in a context,
and I agree with you,
of
why
development, you cannot, as a, all the issues that you refer to, including this experiment of the IGZ, and the issues that Mr. Bisek is referring to, are primary issues. That it, are rather secondary issues. The primary issue, when you create SEZ in a country like South Africa, should be about job creation.
That's what I'm saying.
Everything else
you,
becomes secondary, Mr. Bisek. I want to maintain this point.
No, I know that what you're saying, because that's why I'm saying the message, Babu Ngonyan, the message from Mr. Bisek is that this is how what he believes from the work that is done. Yes, and I agree with you that we don't have space in South Africa for that, the type of experiment that you were talking about. But in our own situation, we pilot for, and that's what we call experimenting. We pilot. That's experimenting. But because of the history or historical background, that's why I started by saying we approach things differently in South Africa. And we've been doing so, so far successfully, even to the surprise of the international community, I think so. The issues that you came up with are issues of reality. And some of them that we cannot, you know, duck or dive against, we have to consider them. And I think in the new approaches that we're coming up with, that's exactly what we're trying to do. We may differ in the approaches, but I think the central issues are quite common. Because, yes, we learn from the international perspectives, but at the end of the day, like you said in the definition of SEZ, it involves territory and how those territories, you know, approach issues. I think that is what is important. The goal might be the same, but at the end of the day, how you navigate or how you move towards that goal might be different. And I think that's what we were trying to say. And that's what we must really appreciate in everything that we do. Yes. I just, because now members, we are moving towards the closure of the meeting. Let me really thank Mr. Bisek. I think you brought to us a very fresh approach, a very fresh presentation that's really making us to even understand some of the issues that we're talking to when we were ourselves analyzing the bill on SEZ. I think most of the issues that you alluded to are issues that were really bothering us, and I think they are issues that are bothering our business community in South Africa, because they feel like you feel they need more inclusion in the, whether it's in the governance structure or in the running of the whole thing. But what I like also you are saying, government is there to solve the market problems. But market, government should also be there where there are failures. And government should be there where it feels that it needs to intervene at all times. Yeah, I think the role of government should really be viewed in that sense, so that we don't only need government where we feel we are failing or we are weak. Government must always be there to guide, to do whatever is possible. At the same time, to say, open up and for activity by all role players, not exclusively by the business sector. Hence, we have also the inclusive fora where we involve everybody, and where we decide who should participate in where. And I think that should be appreciated also in the way we're looking at things as South African government. And I appreciate the fact that you understand that in your presentation and you're trying to bring that out. But issues of ideology is true. They always take precedence. As long as they are not abused, it will be always the case. So in thanking you, I just wanted to say I like your honest way of coming out with issues, because you were able to say, yes, you are parliamentarians, you are representing people, these are the issues that you must take into cognizance when you're dealing with the matters before you. And this has been a lesson to us and a good, you know, lesson or presentation to us, and we really want to appreciate your effort, you putting aside all the work that you've been doing in order to be with us here and to share your knowledge, your expertise, experiences, and your foresight into some of the issues that we wanted you to deal with. Thank you very much, and we want to wish you all the best in the work that you're doing, and continue to being honest and approaching things in that honest way. We're not discouraging you.
Thank you. I hope not. And if you were, I would not listen to you. I want to thank you. It's been a wonderful experience for me and an honor. I'm at your disposal. I have a lot of information and articles and books and database on SCZs the world over. It is at your disposal. If you need anything, I can send references to Brenda. I can avail myself for further conversations. Feel free to collectively or individually contact me, and if you have more questions and want information or debate or throw ideas at me, I will try to help you as honestly as I can. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Mr. Sack. Members? Do you have the business card? You don't? You do? Okay. I think if you can share that with me. Where's the thing? No, I need committee assistance. She hasn't done her work. Guests have left without even filling the guest room. 2, 4, 6, I think. 7. Yeah. 2, 4, 6, 7. Yeah.
These cards are my previous focus. I have a business in the US that does zones and a business in the UK that does mining risk, but now I'm merging these two, so that's what it's going to be. So.
Members, our next item always a politician and good, and you're not going to change the mind. Our next item was supposed to be on the report of the entities. Yes, obviously because of time constraints, we won't be able to deal with that report again. But I must impress upon on you on this issue, the fact that we took this decision collectively that we were going to deal with the report of the entities later. And remember that we need a quorum to adopt, for us to be able to adopt that report. Unfortunately, on Friday, we could not form a quorum, hence we could not discuss. I'm appealing to you as members, honorable members, especially from the opposition. Please avail yourself, because without you, won't come across. So that we deal with the reports and other reports that are still outstanding, minutes and so forth. They need a quorum, all of them. Tonight, we're considering the fourth quarter report of the department, which is also important because we need to know, just to compare. It's important that they present this to us, because from September, when we come back, it will only be July, August. End of August, they are presenting their annual report, and it's supposed to be dealing with their annual report. So hence, it was very important that we conclude on the fourth quarter report, so that we don't confuse what happened in a month with what happened on an annual basis. Yes, we're supposed to be considering that, but because there's an event tonight, we thought we should just dedicate an hour for that and then leave for the event. Yes.
So meet at 5:30?
We can meet at 5 if we can, so that we can deal with that. Yeah. Is that fine? Members, then the meeting stands adjourned. Thank you very much. See you at 4. Oh, sorry. I decided now to monopolize.